You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Katie Frankowitz. Approximately 80,000 gallons of sewage washed out at the Gower Street Beach access area in Cannon Beach Monday morning. The city says the overflow was due to high rainfall and an accumulation of toilet paper around a flow sensor device that had been installed in the manhole to collect data about high bacteria counts. The city is asking people to avoid the Gower Street Beach access for now. City crews were on site yesterday, and the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality has been notified. Clatsop County recently settled with two former employees from the district attorney's office for more than $114,000 total. The settlements come in the midst of an ongoing investigation into workplace conduct issues at the district attorney's office. The two former trial assistants named in the settlement agreements told KMUN they left their jobs after witnessing and experiencing bullying, harassment, and invasion of privacy, working in a hostile atmosphere that they say eventually took a toll on them mentally and physically. Kaylee Kinney and Krista Chris were both on medical leave related to their jobs around the time the workplace conduct investigation began. They ultimately decided to quit their jobs. Kinney and Chris say it's a situation that didn't need to happen at all and that the settlements are expenses the county could have avoided. They said the county has been hearing complaints about the district attorney's office for years and has done nothing. Kinney said the district attorney's office is pivotal to the workings of the criminal justice system.
Whether you've been in trouble or not, you know someone that has been in trouble or has been a victim of a crime. And so whatever side of that is that they're on, you know someone that has dealt with the district attorney's office in some capacity. And without that office functioning, that just has a widespread effect, again, on agencies and individuals themselves.
At the Clatsop County District Attorney's Office, District Attorney Ron Brown oversees a staff of 20 people. He was elected to his position in 2018 following the retirement of Josh Marquis, who held the post for 24 years. Brown ran unopposed and won a second four-year term in 2022. But under Brown, others oversee different aspects of the office. Chris and Kinney described lack of oversight from their direct supervisor, a woman, and said that Brown was a benign but distant presence. Earlier this year, Kinney filed a public records request for inner office messages sent between various coworkers. She later showed the messages to county administrators. The workplace conduct investigation followed soon after. In messages KMUN reviewed, female coworkers describe other women in the office using sexist slurs. They comment about coworkers' medical conditions and discuss or speculate about other private information. In the messages, Chris saw how coworkers discussed and gossiped about a restraining order she filed against her ex-husband. In the day-to-day work, Chris said she saw a lack of professionalism, a lack of training, and a lack of oversight. She said there was an atmosphere of competitiveness between employees that she felt ran counter to the mission of the work they were doing.
I understand that not everybody you meet or work with is going to be nice. You're not going to get along with everybody, but there is definitely a line that should never be crossed. And that line was being crossed on a daily basis with absolutely zero regard for the individuals that it affected.
The county confirmed that the settlements with Kinney and Chris had happened, but declined to comment on them or on any aspects of the investigation. In the settlement documents, the county does not mention the investigation or list any reason for the agreements beyond marking the end of the women's employment with the county. Instead, the documents refer to the money paid to the women as severance pay, broken up across three categories: for alleged economic damages, for alleged non-economic damages, and for alleged attorney fees. I'm Katie Frankowitz reporting. To read more on this story, go to kmun.org/news. Christine Drazen is running for Oregon governor again. The former House Republican leader announced her campaign at a manufacturing facility in Portland on Monday. OPB's Bryce Dole reports.
Drazen walked beneath a large American flag and stepped onto a stage before dozens of workers. Her voice echoed through the room's high ceilings as she made the case that Oregon is heading in the wrong direction.
For too long, government has managed misery instead of ending it.
Drazen is among Oregon's most influential Republican lawmakers. She last ran for governor in 2022. She lost that race to Governor Tina Kotek by less than 4%. Her speech touched on many of Oregon's biggest problems. She pledged to cut taxes and regulations to make the state an easier place for Oregonians to work and live. Her campaign is likely to face headwinds, as parties in power seldom do well in midterm election years, and she could face a rematch with Kotek. The governor is expected to run for re-election, but has yet to announce her plans. I'm Bryce Dole, reporting.
In Bend, over the weekend, family and community members gathered for the dedication of a permanent memorial for Barry Washington, Jr. He was 22 and unarmed when he was fatally shot outside a downtown Bend bar in 2021. The event sparked protests against anti-Black racism. Catherine Steyer-Martinez reports.
LaWanda Roberson lost her son 4 years ago.
This has been the biggest struggle I've ever had to deal with in my life.
One of the images that we see a lot of is Barry smiling. He's got this big old grin. He's got his hat on. Tell me about that. Tell me about Barry's smile.
Yes, he has a big smile, and he was silly, and he had a goofy laugh. Like, when he laughed, it was so contagious. Like, even if you didn't think something was funny and he was laughing, when he laughed, like, it would make you laugh because of his laugh. The memorial is very sacred for me, so the fact that it's going to be a permanent memorial, I'm very honored.
May we continue to say his name, Barry Washington Jr. Thank you.
Catherine Steyer-Martinez, reporting.
We turn now to news from Washington State. The state agency in charge of investigating police use of deadly force is planning to expand. The Office of Independent Investigations currently operates in 12 counties in a swath of western Washington. They plan to announce another region where the task force will operate and a timeline for expanding throughout the state in the next few weeks. The department is tasked with independently investigating deadly force incidents and developing a report that's not written in legal speak so the public can understand it. Agency Director Roger Rogoff defended the office's mission during an interview on TVW's Inside Olympia.
This is a really good idea. You want to have the community trust these investigations. You want them to be independent. I mean, it's really a divine idea. In order to make it work, we're going to need the resources to do it.
The agency has 31 investigators, but Rogoff says he needs about 100. For now, Rogoff said he is asking the state to fund at least 5 more investigators. The agency has completed 2 investigations in Vancouver and Centralia since it launched last December, with 3 more cases pending. If you have your ballot for the November election, there's an important proposed amendment to the state constitution at the top. KUOW's Scott Greenstone has more.
If you make a paycheck in Washington, chances are you're familiar with the Washington Cares program. It's 58 cents out of every $100 you make, and it pays for long-term care for elderly Washingtonians. Elizabeth New is not a fan. She's an analyst with the Libertarian Washington Policy Center, and yet she's voting for an amendment that could grow Washington Cares.
I think WaCares needs all the help it can get. We need it to succeed. People's wages are being taken.
Care is expensive. The program could be insufficient with current funding, so the amendment New is voting for would allow the state to grow the fund by investing in the stock market. A new poll from the left-leaning Northwest Progressive Institute has almost half of voters saying yes. I'm Scott Greenstone in Seattle.
More and more Americans are trying to understand the influence of Christianity in their country's politics. Kristen Cobus-Dumais is a historian at Calvin University who specializes in the intersections of religion, politics, and gender. She visited Spokane last week and sat down with Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham to discuss how a fringe strain of Christianity has come to dominate the national conversation.
Dumay published her book, Jesus and John Wayne, How White Evangelicals Corrupted a Faith and Fractured a Nation, in 2020. It traced how some Christians replaced God with cowboys, and it quickly became a New York Times bestseller. Her next book, coming September 2026, focuses on evangelical women. It's about multi-level marketing schemes and how cruelty came to be seen as purity. Dumay visited Whitworth University last week to present some of the work that went into the book. The next morning, I interviewed her about her research. But first, I had to ask, is this interaction between Christianity, gender ideals, and politics new?
What I can say is what we're seeing now isn't new in that there is historical precedent for this in terms of kind of patriarchal visions of masculinity, visions of authority and hierarchy and these sorts of things. If you look particularly in conservative evangelicalism, you can find a much longer history here. What is different today, I think, is the more extreme versions of this that we're seeing. So these are no longer kind of fringe movements. They are movements being embraced, an ideology being embraced by those with significant political power. And so I think the implications for the wider kind of national conversation for the public are different this time around.
And yesterday you said something that really interested me. You said that people who can have never set foot in an evangelical church but still be steeped in evangelical culture. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, so I'm a cultural historian, and I am interested in popular culture and things like the Christian publishing industry and Christian radio, Christian music, and now we're seeing it also in terms of kind of podcasts and a wider influencer culture. And so this value system really does spill out of kind of formal religious spaces to influence the wider culture.
And what are kind of the hallmarks of evangelical culture?
You know, within evangelicalism, you can find a number of different traits, characteristics. There's different kind of theological traditions that come together. It's a pretty expansive subculture, and so there is variety within it. But the dominant strains that we're seeing particularly emerge in recent years is a kind of, you know, what they would call complementarianism, an idea of very separate roles, opposite roles even for men and women, male authority, kind of hierarchical ordering of society, conservative views of gender and sexuality, and along with that, a sense of wanting to seize cultural power, seize political power, a sense that the rest of culture is kind of against them, but they are God's representatives and are on a mission from God to take back this country, to redeem society.
And you introduced me to a term yesterday that I had never heard before, holiness evangelicalism. Can you describe what that is and what in the world that has to do with our political conversation right now?
So there are many strands of evangelicalism that come together, and holiness evangelicalism is one that traces its roots back to the 19th century, to evangelical revivalism, what we call kind of perfectionist theology. The idea that you could become essentially perfect, that if you were able to confess your sins and tap the power of the Holy Spirit, that Spirit could consecrate you and essentially make you perfect. At least all of your intentions would be. This helps give rise, over the course of the 20th century, to some kind of distinctive characteristics of evangelicalism. And it contributes to a kind of us versus them mentality, that if you are one of the sanctified, right, then all of your intentions are going to be holy and everything that you do is going to be good. And if you're not, if you're one of, you know, the others, if you're on the outside of the system, then you don't have access to that good. You aren't part of what is righteous and holy. And so that really contributes to a kind of us versus them mentality, which we can see in recent years is really at the the heart of Christian nationalism, not seeing us all as kind of part of one community in this country, and not seeing that there can be, you know, good outside of their own spaces, but the idea of seeing anybody on the outside as a threat or as an enemy.
You mentioned that this way of thinking about Christianity has become so pervasive that sometimes people assume that's what Christianity is. Are there ways to conceive of the Christian faith, whether you are part of it or not, that's different than holiness evangelicalism?
Yeah, and I should say that even holiness evangelicalism has a number of different variants, right? And so I'm tracing one that really evolves into a more coercive kind of framework. But there are many iterations of Christianity, right? We're talking about evangelicalism, and which is part of the Protestant tradition. You've got, you know, Orthodox and Catholic variants. You have in this country, the Black prophetic tradition, and just so many different approaches to the scriptures, approaches to how God works in this world. And, you know, in many, there is a different understanding of how sin works. The idea that all of us are kind of tainted by sin, which means that we should all have a sense of humility. We could be wrong. We might not be getting everything right. And in many traditions, there's a stronger sense of common grace. The idea that even those who haven't confessed Christ, even those who are outside of the faith, may have can be in possession of truth, and that Christians can learn from non-Christians, and that, you know, Christians in a particular sect of Christians do not have total access to the truth. And so certainly within Christian traditions, there are so many approaches to how to view non-Christians, how to view their public role, how to view their political role. But what we see happening in recent years, recent decades even, is that the Christian right has worked to restrict kind of the definition of Christianity and true Christianity into kind of ever narrower circles of essentially whatever aligns with their right-wing Christian agenda.
I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News Team. That includes host and producer Skylar Butenshin, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and me, news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. You're listening to KMUN.